Welcome to Pull Up a Chair. I'm Bina Mehta, the chair of KPMG in the UK, and in each episode, I talk to some of the world's most influential leaders and thinkers about sustainable growth, what it means to them, and why it matters. We also explore the challenges and opportunities of delivering growth responsibly and ethically in a way that meets the needs of people, planet, and profit. I'm so pleased to have Penny James with me today. Penny is a co-chair of the FTSE Women Leaders Review, an independent business-led framework supported by government in the UK. She is also a senior independent director at Hargreaves Lansdowne and QBE Insurance, and has spent most of her career in the insurance industry. We'll be talking about the importance of gender equality and indeed representation more broadly and why it's important to her. We'll also explore what she has learned during her career in insurance and the important role the sector plays in driving sustainable growth. Penny James, please pull up a chair. Penny, I'm thrilled to have you here today. Not only have you got an incredible career in insurance, but you are the co-chair of the FTSE Women Leaders Review, something that we at KPMG are very, very proud of as a co-sponsor of the review in its predecessor forms, which was the Hampton Alexander, and prior to that, the Davis Review. And what progress has been made? It's not only achieved the representation of women on boards, but it's now really motoring ahead in terms of representation and leadership. But thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for asking me. No, looking forward to it.
So look, first of all, let's start with the theme of the podcast, which is sustainable growth. I'd like to just ask you, what does sustainable growth mean to you? Do you think we can deliver to the needs of people, planet and profit?
Well, to me, I guess it's two things. Firstly, it's creating economic value in businesses, but doing it with the right values, because of the right values, rather than despite them. So that we're actually working on behalf of some of the right things and good things in society and trying to protect this amazing planet of ours. But it's also about recognizing that we can only do these things effectively if we're getting economic growth. So those kind of things have to work in a triumvirate. Do I think we can do it? I do. I think the challenges that sit before us as a society and as a planet are not things that we can solve in individual businesses or individual groups of politicians can resolve. We can only resolve them through collaborating cross-sector, for want of a better phrase. So it requires leaders, political leaders and business leaders who are prepared to step into that and who are prepared to step into that and consider things for the long term, not just for the duration of their term, be that in a role in government or be that in a role in a business. So it does require some leadership change and development. There are some amazing leaders out there who are striving to achieve that. And I put my faith in those people to try and move us forward.
I think, so do you know what, it's fair to say that the work that you're leading as co-chair of the FTSE Women Leaders Review is actually also helping change the nature of leadership, the qualities of leadership, as we look forward. And actually, just before we carry on, a lot of our listeners are actually from overseas. So for the benefit of those that don't or aren't familiar with the FTSE Women Leaders Review, would you be happy maybe just to talk a little bit about the context around that and what you as co-chair are trying to achieve with it?
So the FTSE Women Leaders Review has a very straightforward mission. It's to try and achieve gender balance at the top of British business. And it stems back around 12 years or so in various different incarnations. But effectively, at the time, people were talking about whether to put quotas in. And what began was the review. And rather than put gender quotas in for boards, we moved to a voluntary target base. So all the people, all the firms that participate in the review effectively sign up to a voluntary target. Initially, it was in terms of gender representation on boards. Then it became executive leadership as well. Originally, it was the FTSE 100, the biggest firms. Now it's the FTSE 350 plus the biggest private companies in the country. So around 400 firms participate voluntarily in signing up to these targets and reporting against them. And the review, I think, has two very distinctive characteristics. One is that it operates through advocacy and transparency. And the second thing is it's brutally transparent. and we publish every company name, just factually where they've got to and how far they've come, and in four cases, whether or not they're prepared to play. So it's become really a focal point for the ecosystem of people trying to change the way we operate as a society. The result of that, over the 12 or so years the review has been running, is that women on boards has increased from 9% to 42%, and is now one of the leading countries in the world from that perspective.
I think you're absolutely right. So you talked about the powerful example of the FTSE Women Leaders Review, of a voluntary, business-led movement supported by government to really drive change. And that has taken a lot of progress, a lot of momentum. So you talked about transparency. Transparency is what has held those businesses accountable to either progress or maybe explain why they haven't progressed.
Yep, that's right.
And I would say that the UK has been held as an exemplar across the world. There are many countries that choose to do quotas or other ways of doing it. I'd be intrigued to sort of understand what you're hearing from overseas. What is it that other countries are really valuing or finding difficult?
Well, I think those conversations are continuous. And I don't think anybody has found a magic solution, I think is probably the key thing. I sat in a conference only last week, and their excellences, the ambassadors for Mexico and for France to London were talking. And their journeys in some ways are very different. Obviously, you know, the French through quotas have achieved balance pretty much at the top of, a board level, but done it through a quota system and therefore are still trying to create equity further through the business. We've kind of done it the other way around by trying to create voluntary targets. Actually, when you listen to the stories of each of them, all the same features apply around where bias is coming in, people's, instinctive response where progress is made. And in the end, you still need sponsorship of individuals, people to put their necks out to look for talent coming up through the pipeline and encourage it, whether that's male or female. You still need role models. I was listening to the French ambassador who could quote every other female ambassador that had gone before, and you realise how important that is. So actually, I think it's a very similar set of conundrums that we face, almost however we tackle them.
We recently launched the FTSE Women Leaders Review for 2024, a great representation in the room from business and government. And what it's all about is about embracing the different mindsets, approaches and experience so that women can be influencing businesses at the top. What I'd like to really understand from you is how that representation and equity conversation really extends beyond just the gender.
There are several things that around this. One is, what's the purpose of trying to put gender balance in? It's not, the people who work in and around this view and myself, we believe in inclusivity across it. We want diverse boards, we want diverse leadership. We want businesses where people feel included and have fair opportunities regardless of whatever their background or, ethnicity or any other dimension of them. They can just be themselves and still have fair opportunity. That's the heart of it. Ultimately, it's about getting a variety of minds around a board table. I think there's a wealth of evidence that suggests you get better decision making if you have that. It's not necessarily easier to manage, trust me, but it is certainly brings more to the party, more to the decision making. And in terms of inclusivity across a whole organisation, and if you think about it, the sum of 400 organisations at the scale that we're talking about is influencing society across the UK, but many of these FTSE 100 companies are global as well, so well beyond the boundaries of the UK. So getting diversity and different thought around those board tables stands a much better chance of getting inclusivity throughout the whole organisation.
Inclusivity. So we see a lot of organisations now look at sort of other characteristics of diversity. And there are many organisations that now are promoting that agenda, actually taking the learnings from the FTSE Women Leaders Review. But what I hear from leaders of international businesses is that it's not always easy to action the the ambitions that we have across different geographies. Now, I think that's something that we have to navigate as leaders. I mean, it's just part and parcel of what we do. But when, because the FTSE Women Leaders Review is very specific around the roles and the level, I think it's much easier to sort of navigate. As other organisations embark on promoting diversity, whether it's ethnicity or neurodiversity, etc., any learnings from the FTSE Women Leaders Review that you think you could impart on those organisations?
There are two things I think about the review that are worth noting. One is it's a game of hearts and minds. So, you know, you can't just order people to get the balance right and expect it to change the culture of an organization. You need to work on the culture that sits around that and the things that make inclusivity easier and more appropriate. So that's the first thing. It's a hearts and minds game. The second thing is you only know where you are if you back it by data. Now, the challenges are different in, you know, different jurisdictions. I've worked in global organizations and run D&I across global organizations as well. The challenges are very different if you're sat in the US or in Asia or the UK or Europe. Every country, every jurisdiction and every sector of a business has different challenges. So dictating one solution is not going to get you there. But those two things of creating a culture of listening and respect for other people's positions and having the data and the insight and building sufficient trust to be able to get the data and insight in many cases are kind of the two components that have driven success on this dimension. And I think that remains true of all of the dimensions.
I just want to pick up on the culture point because you've articulated some of the characteristics of how do you create an inclusive culture that then fosters change and progress. You've talked about culture of listening. You've talked about respect of others. Is there anything else from your experience of having run organisations that you'd like to just throw into the mix there?
Well, when I've run organisations, you know, I kind of make a habit of trying to study leaders that I think do things well and, you know, steal bits of what they do. But in this regard, I think there are a couple of things that are critical. One is about trust. You kind of have to, as a leader, build trust with the organization and safe space. And it starts there. And it's not always the easiest thing to start with diversity. Actually, when I started Direct Line, we started with mental health, which is actually a leveler, I think, across many dimensions. But what we tried to create was the habit of having open conversation, not controlled from the top down, but being prepared to have conversation, bring people from the networks in and talk more broadly, being, I guess, vulnerable enough to go on a call with 3,000 people without an agenda to let them tell you what they're concerned about. You know, doing things like reverse mentoring at the senior level. So very visibly, you could express in an authentic way what actually mattered. And then, of course, you have to have an exco that reflects that, both in terms of the way they behave and the composition itself. And I think those two things, if you start to get them moving, create a momentum of their own.
And what you've beautifully articulated, it's not just about representation and role modelling, it's also the environment you create for those coming through to aspire, and then you foster that sort of real sense of belonging, and everybody can thrive, and the organisation thrives, better decision-making. And, you know, so it is actually not just about looking at the targets that you achieve, it's how you create that, and that's really important.
I think that's right. I think it's both trust and belief.
Trust
for
and
people.
Belief, I like that, trust and belief.
Trust, belief they can do it, and trust that you're trying to step through the right path.
Is there anything else you'd like to share in terms of if people want to really make a difference and really push those boundaries, is there anything else they can be doing?
So to our, you know, to our current leaders with voices, I would be saying it is for us to challenge those social preconceptions in all sorts of places. This is not limited to business this is a reflection of society. And culturally, I think that is really important. And that is not just about the role of women, it's about the role of men as well. And again, I don't sit here saying it should be one thing or another. The point is, it should be about personal choice and how do we make that more possible. So that's the first thing I would ask senior leaders to be considering. And there are some very practical things about that. There are some very basic things, you know, equal parental leave, some role modeling, and so on. There are some quite specific things that right now, I mean, 10 years ago, I don't think they were top of the list of priorities. I think it's beholden on any of us that have, you know, made real progress and got to positions of influence to be looking for the next generational talent. Because if I look at the numbers today, we're doing brilliantly on board composition. We're already really balanced there. Executive team composition is not far behind. We're making real progress. It's, call it, depending on which sector, 30%-ish, probably above that. And moving in the right direction. When you get to CEOs, well, there were 15 CEOs in the 350, FTSE 350 in 2012. There are now 21, so we've improved by 6 in 12 years. And so we really need to look at why that's the case. And I think it's beholden on people in senior leaderships now to be looking at the pipeline and going, not just are there enough people in that level, but actually are they going into the kinds of roles that actually can make them the CEOs of the future? You know, will I give them a P&L role? Will I put them, make them my finance divisional finance director? You know, and actually that takes me to the third thing I'd be looking at in that space, which is I think we should all be worrying about the composition of our STEM, the gender balance within STEM, because I sit on a board that's just appointed a technology and data specialist as their CEO. We will not be the last. So as that becomes a pipeline, an increasing pipeline route as well into CEO, I think making sure right at grassroots level that girls are entering STEM subjects and doing so proudly and confidently is really important.
So that's a nice point to sort of move on, because whilst I feel quite inspired by the amount of progress that's been made and is being made by
business,
and we should
be, yeah.
And we should be proud, it really gives me confidence that as we look forward, we can drive sustainable, inclusive growth.
Yep.
That is for the benefit of everyone, all talent and across society. But what I think you've just really hit the nail on is the need to not be complacent, because whilst we've made huge progress, there is so much more to do, right? Whether it's specific roles, whether it's societal preconceptions, and the point you make around making sure that representation, that ability to play a part in the future, and let's not miss a chance or an opportunity to really focus on those.
We get asked whether the review should stop. You know, you've achieved gender balance on boards, you know, job done. And I will always say, until you're gender balanced in the CEO level, then you're not embedded, because those are the people that control the cultures of the organizations where you're trying to impact the lives of millions. So we're certainly not done. There's much to do. But we can, you know, there's lots of evidence that we are capable of doing this.
You've spent most of your career in insurance. You've led businesses. You're a non-exec on many businesses too. I'd just like to get your perspective on the industry and the role of the industry in driving sustainable growth, especially because we, you know, as a consumer of insurance, we know the issues around, you know, whether it's environmental, whether it's, you know, whether it's to do with societal challenges and the role that insurance plays in that. So I'd like to get your perspective on the role of insurance in sustainable growth.
Look, I think it's a really live question at the moment. Nobody gets out of bed in the morning and says, do you know, I want to be an insurance, you know, person when I go up. I might want to be a fireman. I might want to be all sorts of things. No one says, please, mum, can you make sure I go and work for an insurance company? And yet I've been in insurance from various different perspectives for about 30 years. And really that's because I kind of believe in what it's trying to do. The people around you believe in what they're trying to do. It has no end of complexity and challenge, so you're always learning from someone. All of those things have made it an amazing career. But when you come down to impact and sustainable, you know, what's its role in sustainable growth? I mean, broadly, we do three things in that space. We help protect people and businesses from risks. They could be, you know, climate related, it could be theft, it could be all sorts of things, but broadly we do that. We help people plan for their financial futures and their pensions, provision, which is something I think, it depends which country. In the UK here, we're not very good at doing that as individuals. I think in the US, people are more intuitive about that. Here, we tend to save money rather than invest money. So we have a really important role there. And then as we gather funds from people, whether it's premiums to help, you know, insurance premiums or whatever, we have big investment pots, you know, trillions of investments across globally. And so the role that we play is sort of quite multidimensional in that growth strategy. It is really important that we are encouraging people to think about how they invest their money and whether they are contributing to the societies and so on in which they're investing. But most importantly, that they're thinking about investing. That is a fundamental driver of economic growth. It's really important, and certainly in the UK, it's been a very hot topic in recent, in the last year or two, and I don't think the UK will be alone in this. What latitude and where do we want as a society those insurance funds, you know, balance sheets to be invested so that they actually create the right kinds of economic growth? We have to get policy and regulation right in all of the jurisdictions to support that funding, the infrastructure and so on, that will support climate change and create the society we want for the future. So that's a really important topic of conversation for the industry. And the third is quite simple, my sense is people don't really yet ask. If you look at the data the insurance companies have on climate, whilst it's difficult to prove what that should mean for your premium this year or next year, because, you know, the climate is getting more erratic and last year's data is not necessarily as good a guide to next year's as it was 10 years ago, we can tell you a lot about who's vulnerable, where, to how much, you know, how much sea levels need to shift, what storm patterns and so on and so forth. There's a lot of data across the industry, and I think we would be wise, this is not limited to the UK again, this is a global conversation, to look with some maturity around politically, and societally about what that means for the society and people that we're in it. At the moment, we worry about the price of insurance premiums. I think the issues are much more fundamental than that, about whether people can get mortgages for their homes, if we know they're in flood zones, whether, you know, villages or towns need to move or have different defences, and how we think about that. I think actually there is a lot more that insurance can do if we can get the right collaboration around those kinds of issues. There's a long history of governments and insurance working together on topics to get better societal outcomes. And you see that happening with some of the pools, sort of the catastrophe pools to make sure homeowners in Florida can, you know, get insurance. You see it with the flood pool in the UK, where again, it's trying to make the price of house insurance on flood, you know, floodable areas accessible to people. You see it on some of the terrorism pools, so that we recognise that in certain areas, the risks become so great that the governments act as a backstop, and we talk about how we do that. You see it in the way insurers work with the security services, because we have data insights on who's driving, what behavior patterns they're doing, and so those are linked into the police and so on and so forth. So there are lots of ways that we link societally with the insurance companies in a collaborative way to get a better outcome for everybody. I just think we need to put that on steroids, because we're now looking at global issues, and there are fora that are developing and have developed that try and work through some of those issues. But given the timescales that we're talking about on climate and the level of impacts we're talking, those conversations I think need to to escalate and build considerably to get to where we need to go.
What qualities do you feel are really important as we look forward in terms of leadership skills?
It's a fascinating question, isn't it? I think I'm always intrigued why, when you see either very successful or great leaders, this isn't limited to business actually, what it is that they do or bring that makes them successful. And I think we've had times when that's been about structure and order and, you know, discipline. And those things are all important. But I think the leaders of tomorrow need to have a broader context as well and need to be prepared to play in some of those longer term debates. And I think they're increasingly required to open an engagement of trust with their organizations and their customer bases and beyond, to be much more transparent and open about what they're about.
I'm also intrigued about purpose. You started this conversation about economic value, but economic value that is consistent with the values and having the right values. But actually a lot of what we do and what we believe in comes from our purpose. I'm interested to hear how you feel your own purpose has evolved.
It's really interesting. It's an interesting question because I don't think you set out on a career going, my purpose is, I set out a career going, oh, you know, if I achieved assistant manager, that would be really amazing. And certainly I think the early part of my career, I would say, was dominated by curiosity, actually more than anything else. I can remember I was very fortunate to get asked to act as the note taker and agenda setter for an executive team in a company that was, you know, no longer exists, called Allied Dunbar, which was one of the leading life assurers at the time in the 1980s in the UK. A lot of the people around that table went on to very senior positions across the insurance industry. And I had the fortune of kind of being in the room with them when I was in my mid-20s, watching the dynamics and going, you know, you don't want to say that to him because he's going to absolutely, he'll shut you down, you know. And you start to begin to realise that actually, even the most senior people are not so very different. And from that realization on, it became a matter of curiosity as to how I could, you know, how far does this go? And I think the value question built in time over a couple of incidents, actually, really, where it became clear to me I didn't want to work with people who didn't have what I would call decent values. If I didn't like the way they were treating people within the organization, then that was not for me. And, you know, and that would have been, I guess, the mid-90s. And at that stage, I don't think people discussed things in those terms. Now that's quite obvious, but at the time it wasn't. So I sort of incrementally learned that my lines were in different places, perhaps to some others. As I sit here now, when I look at the businesses I want to work with, have the fortune to work with, I try and tick two boxes. One is that it's emotionally rewarding, and one is that it's intellectually rewarding. And the first of those is about, can it create a positive impact on society? I'm always interested in businesses and people, so I'm quite broad in the dimensions, but I've just joined a board called Mighty in the UK. And most people think of Mighty as a cleaning company. It does facilities management for buildings. But when you think about it, it's 5 million people a day go through the buildings that it looks after. It looks after the security of a third of the retailers in the country. It's got a huge variety of things that are actually very impactful. I find that absolutely fascinating. So it has to be emotionally rewarding. But the intellectual, what I've learned over the years is my brain works in patterns. I can spot patterns in people, spot patterns in data. So the thing I can bring to the party is joining those dots. So that's the way I think I can help best. So I look for the things that create an intersection between those two. I'm not sure whether that constitutes a purpose or not, but it's kind of the way I think about it.
It is kind of, because you've talked about it. It's about making an impact, but your way of making the impact is by bringing those strands together that maybe others don't see.
Yeah.
So actually helping others to see that is not a bad thing to be doing.
Especially if you're on a board. Yeah,
absolutely. What sustains you beyond work?
Oh, family and friends. I've got, I have leveling influences all round. It's irrelevant whether you have a good day. I've had some very good days and some very bad days, as you know. Your family don't care. They just want you home, you know, being you. And I have a bunch of friends who are very similar as well.
So Penny, what really strikes me is everything is about the human, the person, the individual. And we started the whole conversation around economic value. You started from economic value being linked to values. And then we talked about the FTSE Women Leaders Review and then the work of the insurance industry. And in that conversation, you talked about emotional and intellectual, the importance of those. But actually what comes through loud and clear in everything you've talked about is the importance of hearts and minds with business in mind. Thank you so much for joining me today. That's been an incredible conversation.
Thank you, Bina. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today on Pull Up a Chair, whether you're at home, at work, or somewhere in between. I do hope you'll join me next time for more insights from business leaders and thinkers on how to unlock sustainable growth that delivers to the needs of people, planet, and profit. Goodbye.